asking yourself what you're trying to convince yourself is true, and acknowledging that freedom and something quite possibly better might be being open to the opposite. Just not living in my head as much about it, because I don't actually think the solution is there. It's more in the world.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Molly Mielke. She's a writer and the founding partner of Mothfund, an early-stage venture capital firm aiming to increase the agency of exceptional individuals through investments and grants. We talk about rapidly experimenting with careers, increasing agency, investing in people and ideas, playing off-the-shelf games versus creating your own, being famous among friends, freedom, commitment, and more. Please enjoy.
Early on, you were interested in film and you said you wanted to be a director. And you alluded to the idea that maybe COVID played a hand in changing your course and giving you exposure to other areas, specifically around design and technology. But was there more there at play? Like, why exactly did you make that leap from film and directing into tech? What caught your eye?
I think it was mainly finding people within tech that I really, really admired and wanted to be more like, and realizing that I was not going to have access to the people that I really admired within film and entertainment for a long time, because it's far more hierarchical and you really have to put in your dues. It's a culture that really wants to kind of like have everyone forged in the fire together, which I do respect. I think architecture is similar, law is similar. There are a lot of industries that are like that. But in comparison to tech and the way that an intern is allowed to like build a product, like it was pretty night and day. And to me, the choice was pretty obvious once I gotten a taste of that and started to like really find my people. And it was also like somewhat interesting to me how transparent tech was about like who was friends with who and where. And like it was just a smaller community that felt more tight-knit. And that was attractive too, because I felt like I could see a path for myself in the future of like weaving myself into the fabric of this whole world, versus like entertainment and these other ones. They just felt really old and kind of run by people that I had no idea who they were. And it there wasn't that same kind of like warm, fuzzy feeling that I got. Because I think tech in general is much more of like a almost family-esque. Like YC used to have this mentality of like bring people to dinners. I think that's somewhat translated to kind of the whole industry of just like this high openness culture and really attracting interesting people. And I wanted to be a part of that. So I think it was pretty clear, even though to my parents, they definitely thought I was going crazy.
And then you, after getting into tech, realized that instead of building, although you are still building your own brand and company, you instead wanted to have kind of a large amount of surface area, exposure to a number of companies, be able to help them. Why did you make that switch, or why did you figure out that that was the place to be instead of building companies?
I think that I realized pretty quickly that from being a product designer, I'm not nearly as motivated by becoming a craftsperson at the level of like pixel details or code or anything like that. I would look at career ladders like that and I'd be like, I don't care though. Am I supposed to care? I just don't find that motivating. And yet I really loved having like highly forward-looking and intellectual and rigorous conversations with people that were building. So there was something about like, I wanted to be around the people, but I wanted to be around the people that were doing it at the like thought level, not as much at the pixel or like the code level. And I found it hard to like find a place for myself at that level because I was so junior. But being a consultant got me closer, and then being an investor got me even closer to like the actual founders. So I think it was kind of like warming my way up to the areas where I knew I could learn the most. And I think realizing that because I'm not motivated as much by the like craft detail stuff, and I am much more motivated on the day-to-day by just helping and learning from people, I think that it's a good fit and not as much of a trade-off as it would be for others. I find myself a bit apprehensive about a lot of young people who want to be investors, and they don't realize that they are still motivated by like the company building and like having those reps under their belt and objective things to point at as their output. But I think for me, like, I long-term would love to write books and like stuff like that. Like, I'm much more like, I want to build relationships, have an interesting life, learn a lot, and help some amazing people and be around them. but I don't really want to build like a company. Like that's just not my personality. And like coming to terms with that, I think was just like a big reckoning, because all of the messages around me were that this is the thing you should be doing. Like you're right. in the position to do it. What are you doing? There could be huge returns, but I'm like, yeah, but how sustainable is it? Like, I just don't think that this is like my thing. And I think I was lucky again, just like finding the investors who really treat this more like a small business. They were really inspiring to me and kind of opened my eyes that there is like a different alternate path. And that this universe has to operate on the assumption that founding a company is the most high status thing. And that's wonderful. And I agree for what it's worth. But at the same time, on the individual level, I don't actually have to subscribe to that or like beat myself up because I'm not doing it. If there's something else that I know to be a better fit for like who I am and what I want to do.
You strike me as having this rare quality, especially at your age, of being able to quickly experiment or dabble and find what it is you like. And iterate or pivot quickly. I think a lot of people, myself included, it's a much more gradual process. Or maybe I have identified that there's something I'm more interested in, but hesitant to kind of bring it out and make the change in reality. What do you attribute that quality to? And how does someone go about cultivating that or kind of listening to that inner compass more than all the external noise?
It's a good question. I think most of it is just having really good friends and having people around me that are farther along in their career and can give me good advice. I think I've been lucky that I have a lot of friends that are like 10 years older than me that can look at the problems that I'm having. They're like, oh, I had that. And sometimes it's kind of annoying because I'm like, no, mine's different. But at the same time, a lot of times they're right. And they can be like, how do you actually feel in these? Because you can ask the question of like, what would make you the most proud of yourself right now? And like, you know, hype, just jumping on something that will get people really excited about what you're doing. Or you can ask the question of like, what do you actually want long term? And the former is going to be much more interesting in terms of like the actual long term potential of what you can do with your interests. And I think, again, yeah, just it's finding good friends and then finding people that are like you too. Like, I think I found the people that were more treating their life like a series of projects, and they're like, this will be your moth fund chapter and you'll do it for maybe like 10 years and it'll be awesome. And then you can go on and like do documentaries or something like that. And that's fine. And like, you're not constrained to just like this industry, which I think is often the thinking is like sunk cost fallacy. Like I'm so dedicated. I need to like prove myself, right. All these things. And usually those are just totally self-imposed. I definitely felt this at the beginning of fundraising, even for my fund, of like, you know, I'm telling the story of investing in young people and all this stuff. And then anytime I have to make any changes or I'm actually confronted with real decisions, I'm like, oh crap, I need to like stay true to the story that I told them. But actually, like, I think I was pretty careful to filter for LPs that care much more about my taste in people and less about like the story I told them before. It's not like I'm lying. They were much more bought into just like me managing some money for them than they were on like what individual words that they don't even remember I said. But we hold ourselves to those things so staunchly. And I think it is kind of like a sunk cost fallacy, or like latching at the few things we can to claim as our identity. So I think it's just like putting things in perspective. I've learned to do the hard way. And I think I've made enough switches too early in career that I found out it just didn't cost that much. And then I was like, I'm never going to stick with anything any longer than I have to, because it's actually hurting me more than anything else. And I shouldn't just grow resentful in something I don't like.
Right. Derek Sivers has this excellent way of visualizing the amount of time you really have in life to work on a number of things, where he says, break up your life into multiple 5 or 10 year chunks. And when you do it like that, you could have 5 or 10 different discrete careers. You can build a network and expertise on the order of 5 years. But I think especially for people starting early in their career, it's hard to have that mentality. You've been trained to think that you're going to do one thing forever, and you need to develop that network and skill set and stick with it. One of the reasons it sounds like you attribute, or one of the things you attribute this long-term mindset to, is, and you use this phrase in your writing, you want to be famous among friends rather than, you know, more widely popular. How do you go about picking those friends? And maybe there's particular qualities you're looking for But what are you looking for in developing, as opposed to saying, I'm going to have this, this external group of 100 quote unquote famous people that I look up to and idolize. You're saying it's going to be more localized, inward. There's going to be a handful of people. So you have to be really selective about them. So curious what that process is like.
It's a great question. I don't feel like I have all the answers to this. But I do think that, first of all, the genesis of thinking in those terms is more like, I actually just think that's how we're wired to work. Like, I don't think we're actually wired to be competing with like thousands of people. I think we're more wired in like a small town scale. And so it's kind of almost recreating your own small town is kind of how I think about it. But I do think that there's a certain amount, and it's different for everybody, of like exploration and then exploitation. Like, I went through a process of meeting tons and tons of people through working at a bunch of different companies and just being like a person online and all this kind of stuff in tech. And I realized I really liked the people here. I kind of found my niche to a certain extent, and people that were like-minded and a lot of shared values. And once I had kind of like narrowed that down, after I met a bunch of them, it was more like, okay, who are the standouts? Like, who are the ones that I keep talking to that I just really find that it is effortless when I talk to them, but also like, I don't mind like putting in the effort. Like, I want to be around them a lot.
Yeah.
And we really just get each other. I think that there is, especially for people who are a little bit more kind of artistically minded or like thinking about ideas and feelings and people and stuff like that, there is actually a cost to having to explain yourself all the time. And so if you can find the ones that you don't have to feel like you're explaining yourself to all the time, they just get you and you get them, that's a really beautiful thing. And it can help you make more of your art or your thing or be more inspired. So I think that that was pretty obvious to me pretty quickly, like who those people were. And then just doubling down on them and like actually seeing them regularly is just literally an effort thing. And I don't think anyone or is like beyond just setting reminders to do that kind of thing. It's like very much worth it, even if we feel like it's cringe. And then I think it's also, yeah, like picking some that are more your, the people you can depend on to be there for you always and super loyal. And then picking some that are more kind of like aspirational friends that you're really inspired by. Maybe they're spiky in certain verticals that you find really aspirational, but are not exactly like them, but you still have like a shared baseline, but they're, you can't depend on them as much for like the day-to-day support. And then picking some that you're just like coming up with, like you're in the same context. You have so much shared past time. Maybe they're not like the ones that you think are like your most interesting friends, but you've already invested and been around them so much that there's like so much shared understanding of the world and water that you breathe that like that's worth a lot, actually. Again, it comes back to the like not having to explain yourself all the time. I think continuing to like meet new people all the time is exhausting. And at the certain point where you want to keep introducing them into your life, but also just pick some and stick to them. And don't quit on them unless they do something absolutely egregious, I think.
Being this early in your career, and I think you even wrote about this several times, there is a tricky balance between leaning into the advice of those. You had said that you have many friends who are, you know, a decade plus older than you. They've been where you are. It's tricky to balance listening to their advice, understanding that that is in some ways unique and singular. Every journey is different. And then also knowing you want to kind of cut your own path. How do you identify those? What's kind of your filtration mechanism for identifying these are the bits of advice and wisdom that I do want to internalize and act on versus, you know, at this time it's different for me?
I think there's something around advice that has a very long shelf life. Like, there are certain things that are just eternal truths, especially for certain types of people. Like, I think that my having found the people that are more kind of like thinking of their life and projects and have navigated these waters of being in their early 20s before and have kind of arrived at the thing that they now have chosen to kind of dedicate their life to, I think that there are a lot of timeless insights to like that process. And a lot of them are really annoying and trite sounding. And they're like, you know, just keep trying things until it feels right. Like, don't give up too soon. Give it 3 months before you quit, that kind of thing. But they're actually right. Like, they're actually completely right. And those are like things that just don't change. They're insights and advice that like ask in 25 years and it'll probably still be true of building a career or just being a human in the world. And again, I think the same is true for like the friend thing, like harking back to small towns. But I think that where there's an opportunity to like come at things a new and different way is kind of everywhere else. Like things that do change because the world is changing. And that can often be stuff that is like opportunities that lie at the frontier of technology, you being geographically in a new place and it being a different scene or something like that. Just like anything that's new, like, yes, please reinvent. And that will make your life much more interesting. And tactical examples of that are just like, I mean, for me and my fund, I came to it very much from first principles because I, like I said, just didn't really see any other firms that I wanted to model myself after. And so I'm sure I've arrived at many of the exact same kind of like thesis lines and values and all that kind of stuff, because it's true. There is some tactical wisdom that has been true for like over 20 years in venture capital of like investing in people is really good at the early stages, all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, the actual like branding and approach and the writing for the fund and like how I've talked about it and how I've been doing it completely solo and all of these types of things, and my background, I really have any model for of like another person doing it exactly the same way. I have people that I admire, like Michael Moritz. I mean, he was a journalist and a writer and he's incredible and he wrote books and like amazing, cool. I didn't realize that until I already started a fund. Like, I didn't even know that he had that prolific career. And that's because he's kind of quiet. And I kind of like that about venture too. It like allows people to be more mysterious and keep their ideas to themselves until they're ready for the world and not have to be like constantly self-advertising. But yeah, so to go back to your point on advice, I think it's really just like looking for stuff that is true and has stood the test of time, tradition, sure, basically. And then also finding the areas where it's just everything is new, creative destruction, or it's just like net new category creation or something like that. And then please go ham, do something crazy. Like, that's a good place to do it.
Yeah. There's a meta cliche there around taking advice, which is just, yeah, take that which is true and discard the rest. There is this other quality that you have that strikes me, which I think you've also kind of embodied through the aims of Moth Fund, which is high agency, or kind of like on the another viewer perspective of that is almost like fearlessness, which I think is a trait that from early on in our lives through educational institutions is kind of like hammered out of us. And I'm curious how you retained that and how you might recommend people hold on to or cultivate that agency, that sense of agency.
It's such a personal path, but I think that I was quite lucky that, I grew up in a really small town. It was like 1K population. I grew up mostly with my mom, and she's a fiercely independent lady. And has kind of paved her own path and worked for herself for a lot of her career and done all kinds of stuff like songwriting and built trails and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So that was kind of modeled to me that like your life can be really vibrant and interesting if you just make it so. You don't have to wait for anyone's permission. And I also, my education growing up was pretty bad and weird and haphazard. I went to a lot of different like public schools and then schools that were barely even schools and basically just like shells for online classes. But basically I just learned how to entertain myself and like find the things that I was interested in at a really young age. And I was really into art, like really, really into it from grade, maybe like second grade on. And my school had so little going for it that they basically just let me devote like half of every school day to just doing anything I was interested in art-wise. Wow. Which was great for me. It was lonely, but it was also like taught me to be happy just by myself, making my own little games and kind of exploring the world and documenting it. And I think that was like a pretty potent demonstration of agency. Like, this is just like, if you want to make something real, make a project, make a painting, make anything, just do it. And I think I took a very similar mentality when I decided to graduate from high school quite early. I graduated when I was 15. And so I basically did high school in like a year and a half. I just massively compressed it by doing college classes. And that was something that I think was like a very, again, potent proof of concept to myself that like I can kind of do most things that I set my mind to, even if they're hard and not very fun. It's like worth it for the long term. And I was so adamant about going to film school and like fulfilling this vision of being a director. And then I got there and it totally broke my heart that it wasn't the thing because I couldn't afford it. And then I transferred schools and all this thing. But again, it's like that long term mindset and being like, I can do hard things. Like, it's fine. Like, I will figure it out. And it's better to change it now while I'm thinking about it rationally than, you know, basically feel like I'm betraying myself by staying in something that I know is wrong. And I think that's, again, like, it's agency and it's also intuition. It's like you can, if you get enough reps into like trying things and realizing whether they work or not, you can kind of get a sense of most things, whether they would work or not for you,
right?
Because you can pattern match. And I think I actually have noticed that this is a quality that I really like in founders too. It's like, I definitely look for their ability to commit to things for a long period of time and being obsessed with the topic. But I also really value them like really trying, because I think that trying a lot of things, what I mean, I think that you otherwise will always kind of be looking over your shoulder of like, grass is greener, I could be doing something else. And the people that have actually tried all the other things and gotten those reps out of their system and know that they actually weren't that great, mm-hmm. and that finally found the thing that is like the real true one for them and for it to be being a founder, I'm like, oh, cool. Like, that's great, especially when they're young. Because otherwise I'm kind of like, are you doing this because you think it's like the cool thing to do and you can explore on other people's dime? Or are you actually doing this because you want to do this for, you know, 10 plus years? That's what I'm much more interested in.
Yeah.
And you can just kind of tell about people too. I think that there's a certain amount that their ego gets toned down through that process too, because they're humbled by how bad they are at everything.
Yeah.
and they get much less kind of, they're ambitious, but they're also just like, I want to make this amazing. But they also are kind of like, it's crap right now. And I'm like, cool, wait, continue. Yeah, that's right. You're right. So it's little things that stand out.
How do we tactically better empower young people and create environments for them to be more agentic and experiment and dabble more? What's the missing infrastructure, or is it a cultural element? I'm sure it's as with all things, it's complex and it's all of the above, but where might you start in trying to create an environment that better leads to outcomes like yours?
I definitely don't have all the answers. But I do think that project-based learning is like a really special thing. And the earlier that you can get kids making their own projects and passion projects and then abandoning them and then finding other ones and having some that they really stick to, the faster you're helping them get the reps in to prove to themselves of what they can do. And I think that too many people get kind of shrouded in the supposed safety blanket of not failing for a really long time.
Yeah.
And that's not actually good for their development long term. I think that it really holds people back, because, and it also is exactly the force that keeps them stuck in things that they don't actually want to do. Because they're just like, well, I'll look like a failure if I leave, or I don't want to fail. I need to prove to myself that I can actually do this thing. And it's like, do you even want to be doing the thing? Like, because otherwise you shouldn't be doing it. You should find the thing that you actually want to do. And it's hard, because there is a balance between, like, it's not going to be fun all the time, but there's probably, most people can find a thing that they are much more motivated by long term than the one that they're just grinding at. They don't even care about the long term. It's more just to like prove to themselves or their parents or their friends that they're competent and capable and can support themselves. And I also think that like the best reminder I always try to give young people and have been reminded myself many, many times, is like, when you're young, you're the cheapest you'll ever be. Like, this is the best time to mess up. Like, it's harder and harder. And your confidence doesn't get fixed any other way other than failing, basically. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. And there's a lot of environments like tech that are highly supportive of failure. And they actually, you know, they reward people trying and failing more than not trying at all. And I think that that's one of the best parts of technology culture and the, I don't know, the innovations that can happen with like VC returns is the fact that it does kind of like subsidize all of this innovation and all these shots on goal. And other industries can't say that as much. That's why I think it's actually quite good for young people oftentimes that are highly ambitious and get attracted here for the right reasons. But it still hurts a lot. I mean, I definitely went through this too in terms of like my most potent failure or rejection exposure therapy is kind of how I call it, with actually just fundraising, was like at first just getting so many no's from people that I really respected. And I was like, oh shit, like if they think that I shouldn't do this, should I be doing this? Like,
right.
That's bad. But I think I just realized, I mean, it's totally a numbers game. And I just needed to keep pushing. And it's usually never personal. And it's not actually really, like, they might have some opinion about, like, you know, this isn't the right, venture isn't great, or something like that. And it's like, yeah, but that's totally a reflection of them. It's not a reflection of me. And they actually have no idea what I should be doing, nor have they given enough thought to have a valid opinion that I should take into consideration. So I think it's like having had so many no's, that was huge for my confidence, too, in terms of just not being scared anymore. I'm like, the worst that can happen is they're just like, yeah, it doesn't fit, and that's great, cool, that's fine, perfect. But I highly recommend, yeah, like anything that can get you high volume rejection is good.
Yeah, early on.
Yeah,
in your writing you referred to this dilemma of doing things that kind of appease short-term needs and people versus kind of figuring out what it is you actually want with a longer-term orientation, as this battle between playing your own game, playing an off-the-shelf game, versus playing your own game. And one of the, while I 100% that agree with the sentiment, one of the challenges I think as you get older and older is life becomes a little more kind of solidified or hardened in the way that you have certain obligations and responsibilities and lifestyle creep. And you get to a point where, and admittedly, this is a story as well that people tell themselves about why they can't break out of this. But finances in particular become an overwhelming blocker to starting to create your own game and play your own game.
Yeah.
And maybe this isn't an experience that you've had yet, but I'm curious if you've thought about how people who have kind of gone down this path long enough and finally they're over it, they want to break out of it, they want to play their own game, but have these, you know, financial reasons and responsibilities for why they can't do that. How might you navigate that and break out of that that off-the-shelf game?
I think it's really, really hard. I think that there's no like obvious solutions right now, to be honest. I think that I have a couple of friends that have been kind of thinking about and working on this problem from the angle of, yeah, just like later in life career transitions. How do you solve that? How do you get people the support and security that they need to make that leap? And usually it's just like a lot more money, basically. they just need much bigger checks, whether they be grants or some kind of friendly funding in VC terms with the expectation that they really make something. And I think this is often where like foundations and more like old school, almost East Coast finance comes into the picture. Like they have historically supported a lot of these transitions. There have not been many of them, but they have been the primary funder. I don't actually think that tech has any obvious mechanisms designed for that. Mm-hmm. Like it's a new industry. It hasn't really been well thought out. There's a couple like foundations that have, you know, like programs that are more for like innovation fellows or something like that. But they're not really specifically designed for this. But I will say, I think that like there are ways that you can kind of make it a little safer for yourself. All the obvious ones that you probably already heard of, just, you know, having a nest egg, all those kinds of things, and then making the leap and doing it with other people and not being alone and really figuring out what you want and where you're headed. before you make the leap can be really helpful in those cases. Like, what is it you're positively running towards? And how positive are you that that's the right thing to?
Right.
And really, like, test it. I think a lot of people that I have seen make those transitions, they do it by just trying a lot of things out on nights and weekends, basically, before committing to make the leap and make sure it's really the right thing. But they do have to be oftentimes a lot more safety, mostly just for, like, supporting the family reasons, which I totally respect. And yeah, it's way harder. And you're lucky too if, like, you have a family or partnership that can kind of, like, support you in that. But I understand that, like, I think that this is, like, an unsolved problem.
Yeah. What one of the primary reasons I reached out to you was because Wild Moth Fund is a traditional VC fund in some respects. You are also issuing grants to people. And I was just talking with Daniel Strackman yesterday from the Thiel Fellowship. This is a topic that I've been thinking about off and on for a few years and think we need a lot of innovation around, which is just funding people directly without kind of any financial or maybe there's always reputational outcomes, but financial, in particular, financial outcomes as a result. What are the major reasons you see for why we don't have better mechanisms of funding individuals directly? And how might you rectify some of those?
I think it's mainly that it hasn't been proven very substantially as, like, a solid business investment. I think that in retrospect, it's very easy to spot outliers and be like, well, if you had invested in them as a human at the earliest stage, it would have been a right. huge return. It's like, yeah, that's great. Could you have spotted them? Most likely not. Like, VC, the returns are usually generated by, you know, like 1% of the fund or something like that. It returns the whole fund. And that's insane. And I think that it's pretty similar outcomes in if you were to invest in people too, because most early stage investing basically is. And so I think that, like, the main thing keeping that from happening is defensibility, basically, to, like, the funders. It's really hard to actually defend a talent-centric thesis unless you get people to trust you. Like, that's the only way. And trust you and your taste. And with for that, you need basically a demonstrated track record of picking well, either investments or just the people that you're around, and they think that's enough. Luckily, I think that there's enough, like, free capital floating around in VC that it's not that hard to do that. Like, especially when the returns could be in the billions or something like that. And there's small checks always kind of in need of a home. But at the same time, it's still small. It's still capping yourself because it is, you're basically, if you're saying you're talent-centric as a thesis or investing grants, whatever it is, you are probably leaning more into being someone that is known in a, like, if you know, you know capacity and trusting the taste and judgment of other people that you think you have similar taste of. But what you're not doing is you're not saying, I am a B2B SaaS person and branding yourself as such and almost becoming like a bat signal or a beacon of light for people that you don't know from all kinds of places to find you. That will create much more volume and you can have much bigger returns. And that's much more legibly marketing strategy to LPs and funders. But I don't think it actually is necessarily guaranteeing quality. Like, you'll just get a whole bunch of noise and it's potentially not really worth your time. So I think that it really is just kind of like a how many humans can one person have taste in, and, like, how can they find them and how specific is that taste? You're kind of limited as a person how much money you can deploy if you're doing it in a more talent-centric, like, betting on people way. And historically, that has actually worked pretty well in the case of, like, early technology innovation, where they gave access to a pool of capital to, like, PIs, and then they could deploy it at their will and anyone that they were interested in. And that worked because they just picked the people they liked and, like, thought were interesting. And it was not that much money. And they could be doing some interesting things in the world and building their network and meeting people organically without, like, marketing the fund and trying to scale it and have those huge returns. But I think the minute that you are like, oh, no, you have to become a brand yourself, that's where it becomes much harder, because then you're no longer picking people and investing in people. You're investing in ideas, or you're investing in people that are hosting ideas that you like. And that's just not, I don't know, it's just weird, different dynamics. And then I think also, like, yeah, it's just really hard to get buy-in on turning grants into, like, this legible mechanism for status in the same way that philanthropy is. Like, philanthropy has historically been where most people deploy money for, like, impact in a way that is giving back. And that's wonderful. And a lot of, like, the huge billion-dollar tech people still do that kind of thing because it's kind of the only way that they know to deploy money in a philanthropic way. But grants are not, they're still not legibly, like, a thing that you can do into people. Like, that's just not, like, a atomic unit almost.
Yeah.
And so they usually go to institutions. Like, there has to be some kind of, like, mediating thing that legitimizes it. And I think that's a shame. I think that, like, there's a tiny selection of people that have gotten around that by just doing it quietly. But then again, you're capped by it being a very, like, if you know, you know kind of thing. So, yeah, I think it's a very unsolved problem, is my TLDR.
It's much more legible, to your point, to slap your name on the side of a new building on a campus than it is to, this isn't even possible to, like, put a little pin on somebody and say, yeah, I helped them, help give them their start.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope there'll be.
I think much more meaningful.
Agreed. And that's why I hope there'll be a lot more innovation in the space.
Me too.
You had mentioned the idea of investing in ideas versus people. And it raised the question for me of what are some of the maybe non-consensus ideas or sectors that you're eyeing right now as a part of your investment strategy? So obviously, I could ask your take on AI, but it's kind of at this point a consensus space. So I'm curious if there are other areas that people are maybe less aware of that you're excited about.
I like boring stuff.
Great, let's hear it.
I like vertical SaaS. I just think the software is incredible at massively increasing the coordination communication of industries that are historically just living in the dark ages, basically, I think. And that is a very obvious, clear path in my eyes to potentially a 10x return. And so people that are tackling them in a smart and interesting way, and I think have the relationships and credibility to really understand the industry and put in the reps, that seems like that's just an obvious yes to me. I think that I also am interested in, like, fintech, especially in the wake of there's, like, a huge wealth transfer from the boomers to, like, younger generations of small businesses in America. And I think that that's something that fintech could potentially make some, like, very interesting products or paradigms around, basically. Because, like, what is that money going to do? Like, how are they going to invest it? I think there's very different expectations around investing from the younger generations that we had that are, you know, our parents were being serviced by, like, Fidelity and Vanguard and all of that, but I don't think that's exactly, like, the expectation anymore. So that's another sector I'm interested in. I do think I have, like, very armchair opinions on AI from just, like, looking at a lot of companies in Q1. And it's basically that I'm only interested in ones that are either leaning very heavily into being vertical SaaS and very quickly creating a, like, defensible moat that is probably their own model or something like that, and just using it in a way of, like, this just solves a real problem that should have been solved by software anyways, and now right. We can do it way better. Cool. Amazing. Perfect. And if you have the connections and understanding of the industry to match, like, even better. And then on the other side, it's, like, category creation. Like, if there's something that doesn't exist, like the AI in Her or something like that, that you are going to bring to life and totally just change the game in people's expectations around technology and have it be unlike anything else, that's also interesting. I think those are two different personality types almost that are required of each of those. Like, one of them is much more a truth seeking for, like, the category creation, just, you know, rejecting social cohesion, norms, all that kind of stuff. And then the one that is more embedding themselves and trying to coordinate, communicate, like, a problem. That to me is much more of, like, a social cohesion person that is just trying to, like, make things better. I find that really interesting, like, trying to analyze the right personality types for different problems. But
yeah, I was going to say, I like the connections you drew there between, like, psychology or personality and then the problems they're working on. But continue.
It's really fun. Yeah. I think it's a good way to, like, keep yourself interested too in this job of, like, meeting so many people. Like, trying to understand how they think is the best way to both predict how they would act in given scenarios and whether they're really cut out to, like, face all problems when everything inevitably hits the fan, and also just see if you're the right fit to support them. Like, I want to feel like I really agree with their line of thinking. But the thing about AI, my last point is just anything that's in the middle, basically I'm not interested in. And that's most infrastructure, unfortunately, because it's just trying to like make things incrementally better when it's building on ground that's totally shifting. Right. So I find that not super interesting. So those are the three I'm most focused on. And then I think, let's see, is there any other ones? I'm always interested in like future of computing and more just how we work together, creative tools, all that kind of stuff. But I'm not super convinced that there's a ton of like 10x outcomes still there. I think that with all the generative AI stuff, it's really, really interesting. I'm not a downer at all, but I just think that it hasn't really figured itself out yet. And so I'm very kind of tentative to invest in anything unless it's like very explicitly a bet on the founders. And I really think that they can make an amazing product and figure it out, because it's just kind of like, what is the product? Like, we can't just have like all of these, generative things of like storyboarding. And like, who actually uses that? Like, there's just not, I need a real problem that you're solving.
Right.
Either direction, either something completely new or something that's just existing incrementally better, but really momentously so.
It seems like we have this kind of collective and rapid amnesia in tech where like we just went through this with crypto, where it was X plus crypto. Okay, but what's the problem that's actually being solved here? And it feels like this wave, and in fact, a lot of the people who are attempting to do this in crypto have since pivoted and are trying to do it in AI. But it feels like the most fundamental things about building a business are the ones that are most rare or scarce and overlooked, which is just like, what's the problem you're solving? I was reading one of Paul Graham's essays the other day, and just like the amount of times I have to remind myself of this point is scary, frankly. So we were kind of talking on this idea of investing in ideas versus people. One of the important qualities that you've identified that is a positive or a yes for you in terms of investing is whether somebody is a specialist a generalist as opposed to a specialist. Can you give kind of your summary on why you're more bullish on generalists over specialists?
It's funny. I've since evolved my thinking here. I think I am like more in the direction of like T-shaped people now. And that just means that I think that it's really useful to have some kind of core competency. And I actually think I think that's true, because sometimes some kind of core competency mixed with a bunch of generalist skills that really complement it. I think that's useful, though, not probably in the same reason that most people do. I think it's useful mostly as like it proves to a person that their competence and their confidence are like correctly weighted. And I think that that's one of the main failure modes, especially with young people, but also with people of all ages, is if there's a incorrect match there and their confidence is like larger than their competence, like they're more likely to quit, basically, because they're going to be questioning themselves a lot and all these types of things. You want them to really feel steady. And people feel steady when they have proven to themselves that they can do something and put it out in the world and it's objectively good or interesting, or at least it's proven something. In this very like self-actualization progression way.
Yeah.
But I do think that competency paired with like a bunch of different generalist skills is like the best combo, because especially when you're building a company at the earliest stages, if you're not a generalist to a certain extent, like you're just going to spend all your time learning and it's just going to be really, really tough, or you're going to spend way too much money hiring. You should be like generally competent and capable and enjoy that process of like spinning things up and making them happen, and enjoy as many of them as possible too. I think that it always seems like a green flag to me when they're like, yeah, you know, I'm a engineer by training, but I love operations and I dabble in design, all these different things. And it's like, no, that's awesome. Like that really seems like a complementary skill set that's going to take you far. And also it'll give them a sense for what good looks like in a bunch of different categories, because it's often not as much about their ability to do like product design if they're an engineer, and it's more about their ability to hire someone who's good. And it's actually quite hard, I think, to know who is good without having done it yourself. And And also, there's a really wonderful process that happens when you just try it once, and then you're humbled and realize it's really hard. And then you're like, I should hire someone really good. And you kind of know what that looks like. You start meeting those people and you really appreciate them. And that's really wonderful, I think.
You mentioned at the very beginning of the episode that one of the reasons that you were interested in doing VC is because you enjoy doing things outside of VC, such as thinking and writing, and this gives you the space, the latitude to do that. Although I had scheduled this episode with you to primarily focus on the fund and grants, I, through the process of doing my research, came across, I think you have two or maybe even three different Substacks, and just devoured your writing there. And you can see through the conversation we're having here, like, your interest in connecting the psychological, the self to like the work they're doing. And there were a handful of themes that stuck out to me in your writing that I wanted to poke at and get your take on. One of them was this idea, and by the way, all of these stuck out to me. They resonated with me because these are things I think about and write about and butt up against continuously. One of them is this struggle between the rational or the logical and the emotional or the feelings. How have you been able to navigate and blend those or find the right mix of those? And maybe today, kind of, where is your head at in terms of when to use which or how to strike that balance?
I think I'm constantly recalibrating it. And I think my balance of when to use which is like better calibrated in some areas of my life than others. I think that I've put in enough reps in my career in a pretty short period of time that I think I have developed a pretty good intuition that I'm not sure if it's emotional or rational or anything, but I can just kind of tell what's going to be a good fit for me and what I'm going to like. And I know the kinds of work that I enjoy and people I like working with and that kind of stuff in the areas that I'm drawn to and what the qualities are there. And it's just kind of like a felt sense of like, I like this person. I don't. I like, you know, I enjoy this kind of craft detail thing, getting in the nitty gritty of like metaphors and words with somebody. And that's a very like emotional felt thing. But it's also rational. Like, I know that's, of all the things I've tried, it's one of the ones I was the best at. So I doubled down on it. And I think there's like that knowing that like the things I'm doing now are actually, I mean, raising a fund, investing, that's new-ish. But the like, you know, helping with storytelling and words and brand and just writing and building relationships, these are actually the core competency through lines to like everything I did. Yeah. And so I just doubled down on them basically. And I think that's a very rational kind of mindset of like, just keep doing what's working. but I think in other areas of my life where, such as like my creative pursuits and stuff like that, I think I do find it harder to like balance the emotional and the rational. Like, I want to make myself write every week and like put out something consistently. And I know that that's what would make me better. And that's like my rational brain talking. But my emotional one is like, I have nothing to say. Like, I'm in right. a totally different headspace. I'm busy, whatever it is. Some of it is excuses. Some of it's true, though. Like, I can spend time ramming my head against a page. But if the inspiration is there, I'm just kind of wasting time. And I could be writing about something objective and maybe like financial stuff. But I don't think that's something that I am particularly good at or well positioned to like provide value on. And so I think it's just been a process of like refining down in the creative realm. Where can I provide some interesting, unique insight or make something different in a way that will appeal to people? And then doing those things. And I think like, for an example, with writing for the fund, that was realizing that I can write these kind of reflections on what I'm seeing in VC through fresh eyes as someone kind of new to the industry. And that's actually, it's not amazing, but it is a little bit uniquely valuable because there's not a lot of other people that are coming at it with such a like eyes wide open, learning so much about the industry and also the current moment. And doubling down on that and really trying to do that well in a way that feels uniquely me. And that's more the emotion kind of part of it. It's like knowing what I want my writing to sound like and having a high quality bar there. That feels very right. And so it's like going with that gut too and being like, okay, well, I'm just committing. My rational brain will hold me to doing one every quarter, and it will be pretty good and kind of short, but I'll spend a crap ton of time on it. And that is actually enough. And then I'll do, you know, other personal writing when I can. But it's just like a constant negotiation, I think, kind of between rational and emotional brain, right, to be honest.
Yeah, I think I've resigned myself to the idea that this is going to be a forever battle. This isn't something one day that just gets resolved. Although I think they do inch closer towards unification, or rather, maybe you have a better sense because you've taken more reps about when to lean into which. I think we use intuition and like emotional or feelings as synonyms, but I think really the longer you go on, intuition is, or gut is kind of at the root of it, and that guides you towards either the more emotional or practical kind of outcome. These are all armchair observations that I'm still wrestling with, but feels right, as I'm saying it. One of the other themes that stuck out to me is the idea of freedom. And I think your writing around and your writing around, but then also your decision to play your own game versus a off the shelf game is just an indication of like kind of your orientation towards freedom. And so I'm curious what it is that you ultimately want freedom from, and what do you want to use that freedom towards?
It's a great question. Deeply psychological. I think that for me, it was always like financial freedom and freedom to express myself in whatever terms those may be. And I think that for a really long time, how I motivated myself was by trying to, unshackle myself to anything and be completely independent in every way. And then after I graduated college, I think I just realized, I was like, wait, that's not making me happy. Like, I'm completely unshackled. I don't need anyone's help. And this isn't what I wanted. Like, this isn't the euphoric feeling that I thought it would be. And that was a big reckoning in just that commitments actually are what make life feel grounded and stable and makes you proud of yourself. And those can be commitments to ideas, to people, to places, to whatever it may be. And they, for me, freedom is the ability to choose what those commitments are, and not having any of them thrusted on you, or have it be like, well, this is an okay commitment, I'll keep doing it. I think I really value not feeling lukewarm about anything in my life. And if I do feel lukewarm about it, I either want to cut it out or change it. I want to feel like fully committed. And I think that's just because I know that I do my best work when I'm like that. And I know that I can, manipulate my life enough that I can make it better. And I don't want to be half-hearted about things. And so that for me was the process of coming to Raise a Fund was very much like, I had the lowest of the low expectations that I would like it. And then I was super pleasantly surprised by actually really enjoying the work. And then realizing that I could slot in all of these other things that I like to do that are more creative or writing or relationship building as like part of the work of the fund. Right. And then that was like a huge moment for me in realizing, oh my God, this could be perfect. And obviously it's not perfect, but like I've committed to it. I'm going to do it for a very, very long time. And I really like it. And that feels really good because it provides a level of stability. And like, this is my thing. Like, I will make it better if I mess up. It's my mistake. I own it. And it reminds me a lot too of like Joan Didion's essay on self-respect, or like, these are the kinds of things that are the cornerstones of what makes you respect yourself. And again, it's also like the confidence and competence thing. Like, this is the thing that I have kind of put a stake in the ground that I will build as my core competency. And that will in turn, hopefully inspire more confidence and stuff of that sort. And I think that confidence seeps out into like every area of life too, but it's like something you have to like consciously build. And then I think like freedom is also, it's just freedom to like feel and experience the full spectrum of human experience. Like, I don't want to be chained down in any arbitrary way that I didn't choose, like, right, ever.
Yeah, you give me a lot to chew on, reflecting on some of that. what percentage of confidence or interest did you have in starting Moth Fund before you committed to it? I think that there's always this maybe misperception about how you come about committing to a thing. Like, I think for some people, absolutely, at 5 years old, they just have this obsession for a particular topic, and there's this gravity to it that they just can't avoid. But then I think for other people, myself included, where I'm more of a generalist, more of a dabbler, I've been wrestling with this concept of commitment in terms of my work or the creative aspect of my life for the last year. I think I'm ultimately just going to have to choose something to commit to. Like I've experienced enough things in life where there isn't that thing that just like pulls me to it. And so I'm curious, in your experience, were you like 60 or 80% of the way to being really interested in starting a fund, and then you just had to close that last 20% with commitment? Or what was that mix?
I think that it started at around like 15% confidence, and then it steadily grew over time. And around the time that I was at like 65% confidence was when I was like, I actually have enough data points on trying this that proved to me that I do like it more than actually any of the other things that I've tried. And I tried literally all the other things that were on my list and stuff I wanted to do. So that was like, I really crossed everything out. And this was the standout. And that 65% confidence was enough to prove to me, like, I should try to raise a larger fund and see if that works. And like, worst case scenario, they say no. And then once I got commits and it was like really a real thing, I was like, damn, I love this. This is amazing. Like, it totally crept up behind me. And then it was more like the process. I was making like mini commitments to myself the whole way of like, okay, I'm going to do 2 million. Okay, I'm going to do 3 million, whatever it is. I'm going to do it for 2 years or whatever. And then like, yeah, the more I did it, the more like every day kind of inspired that confidence and like just ability and willingness to commit. And that's rare for me. Usually I'm much more of a like idealistic, this is going to be my thing. But I think that like low expectations really are the secret to happiness. And so sometimes like the sleeper hit thing that you never expected can be the one that like is just steadily great and you never really gave it the time of day. But once you do and you really use your rational brain to evaluate it objectively and see what it can be and if it really accommodates the type of like freedom that you want, then I think it's like, then I was all in. I was like, okay, this is great. No, there's no other thing I'd rather be doing. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. And yeah, I think it's like, it's interesting too, because I think there is a certain amount, it reminds me a little bit of like relationship partners as well, in a similar way of like commitment. But I think that you should have some kind of like early good experience in the same way across both like career, where you're like, this is actually nice, I like this a lot. And there should be peaks. But I do think that it's more about the steady baseline, like the person or the thing that it's going to be make you motivated on the day to day for a very long time, that is the better bet for something to commit to. Because otherwise you're just going to be spending so much mental energy convincing yourself that it's good when it's not. And that's not a good place to be in. And that's the one where you're just kind of like wasting your livelihood a little bit on that kind of thing and kind of like living in a delusion. And yeah, I don't want to do that.
Underscoring or kind of supporting this question and discussion of freedom, another theme that came up in your work is this question of who am I? And this, I mean, this is like the most fundamental question you can ask. It's come up on this podcast a number of times. And for you, that seems to be the root or a cause of like this oscillation between action and inaction, between reflection and doing. As you can tell, a lot of my questions so far have come from like this perspective, this like dualistic perspective and how you balance these things. What place have you gotten to in terms of how much time you're spending, you know, doing deep thinking and reflection about who I am versus understanding like there's this treadmill of life moving underneath your feet that's unavoidable. You can't pause it to be super introspective and find everything else. You just got to go do. How have you balanced that reflection versus action?
I think I put in like more than my fair share of time doing the introspection last year. And then I was like, okay, I'm done. I don't want to do that for like a long time.
Yeah.
So I think that like I felt like I needed to get that out of my system more in like an angsty way of like, I need to figure it out. Like, what are the commonalities between all the things that I've done in my life and like what feels like me? I think it was interesting because I did that reflection in an environment that was very much not me. So it was kind of like a test of like, when you are removed from your environment, what do you still hold as dear? And that was really revealing, actually, because I think it proved that so many of the things that I was like, you know, being a nature person and being around animals and like beauty and photography is so important to me. But do I actually choose to add it back into my life if it's not a given, not always around me? And the fact of the matter was kind of on some of the things, but not as much as I thought. They weren't as core to my identity as I, or as stable, like kind of cornerstones. And that was actually quite sad, I think, like that process of realizing that these things are not actually me, and me is something I can reinvent or completely change and is constantly at the whim of my environment, actually more than I thought, was very just calcifying. And then choosing what I wanted to add back in was kind of like a process that was less contemplative or meta and more actually just based off of what feels good. I think I've learned that I was overthinking a lot of things in my life and I should actually just be listening more to like what I enjoy and what makes me kind of happy and feel alive and following that. And again, it's kind of like an intuition thing. And I feel like I built this up in career, but I built this up less in like other areas of like people and friends and extracurriculars and stuff like that where I live. And so I was kind of like going through that process of learning how to do that in other areas and building that intuition. And it was good. I think it's definitely helped, but I don't think that I came out of it with the thesis that being too meta is actually not good. Like I think I was wrong about most of the things I was telling myself. I was with a lot of stories and all these types of things. It's better to just kind of like exist in the world and live and let, you know, the treadmill walk along it, embrace the beauty of it. And when something really catches your eye, like actually honoring that and like being like, I should go after that thing because it's kind of what life is for, is well worth it as well. So that is a rambly answer, but I think it's a constant balancing act.
No, that was excellent. I may have primed you for this, but there is a final question I ask all listeners. Most of which have responded with some variation of who am I? Yeah, hopefully I didn't prime you too much for this. But what's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to act on or think about?
It's a great question. I think the one asking yourself what you're trying to convince yourself is true, and acknowledging that freedom and something quite possibly better might be being open to the opposite is one that I have been thinking about a lot lately, and have found some deep insights from really contemplating deeply and also not even thinking about it, just like holding in the back of my head as like anything that could quite possibly be an answer being like something I flag and then just kind of like let percolate and see what happens by discussions with friends and just not living in my head as much about it, because I don't actually think the solution is there. It's more in the world. And that's like a very hard process because I'm a very meta person. But I do think that that question holds a lot of insights.
Beautiful. Awesome. Well, Molly, thank you so much for your time. This was a blast. And hopefully we can do this again at some point.
Look forward to it. And it was totally my pleasure. Thanks so much.